Hey everyone, it's Jacob here. Welcome back to another episode of the Law of Code podcast. This is the show covering the legal side of crypto, NFTs, DAOs, and any other blockchain-related innovation.
Anything mentioned in this episode by Jacob Robinson or his guests is not legal advice or investment advice. All opinions are Jacob's and his guests alone. Nothing discussed today should be relied upon for legal or investment decisions. This show is solely for information and entertainment purposes only. Jacob and his guests are not your lawyers, nor are they investment advisors. Please work directly with a lawyer or investment professional.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Law of Code podcast. My guest today is Rodrigo Sierra. Rodrigo is crypto counsel at Paradigm. Prior to Paradigm, he was outside counsel to crypto investors and entrepreneurs at Cooley LP. Prior to that, Rodrigo was a founding member of DLX Law, a blockchain and crypto-focused boutique that many of you know well. Rodrigo earned a JD from Harvard Law School and a BA in philosophy and political science from Middlebury College. Rodrigo, it's great to have you here. It's probably about time we did this because I know we've been talking for a while.
Thanks for having me, Jacob. Excited to get into the conversation.
So let's start with your Genesis block. And I typically like to start here because there's always has a different path that they took to get to Bitcoin. What was yours? Where did you first learn about it and what were your initial thoughts?
Sure. So I grew up in a kind of big extended Mexican family. And it was in that backdrop that I first heard about Bitcoin from my brother. I think it was like 2014. And I remember we were like sitting at the Christmas dinner table with my extended family talking about it. And my initial reaction was that I didn't really get it. And I had, I think, a lot of preconceptions that kind of prevented me from understanding the potential of Bitcoin. I was at the time in law school, had worked at big law firm in New York on like sovereign debt restructurings. And my grandfather, who was somebody that was really influential in my life, was Minister of Finance and had his defining career moment was devaluing the Mexican peso. So the idea of like money and the state were like really kind of hardwired into my brain. So it just made no sense that you could have money backed by nothing, quote unquote, right? So I was kind of dismissive of it, but it stayed in the back of my mind for a while as something that was interesting. And it was when the Ethereum white paper came out and started seeing a lot of activity, kind of fundraising with ICOs, that it really clicked for me. And it was kind of the idea of crypto, not so much as just a payments mechanism, but as a way to incentivize collective action that I thought was super cool. So that's kind of what, when I started really devoting a lot of time to it.
And did you bring it into your legal practice at that time? Like, did it start to slowly dribble in or was it something that you were learning about on the side at that time?
So it was started first on the side and then I tried to dribble it into my practice as much as I could, but I was at a kind of big white shoe law firm in New York. So I would grab the senior capital markets partners by the lapels and yell at them about ICO this and like they're more using the venture. And they would all look at me like I was crazy and give me a mix of this is for criminals or they could never afford our rates. But I tried slowly to bring it into my practice by doing things like organizing a reading group at the firm and circulating news articles or regulatory enforcement actions that I thought were important to people in the firm. And then started going to conferences. And it was, I met Lewis in, I think it was Consensus 2016 in New York when he was just about to launch DLX publicly. And I like kind of went up to him after a panel and like told him who I was, that I really wanted to get into crypto. And that's how I was able to kind of like fully jump in.
It's cool to think back to those days and how different the industry looked. I'm sure the conferences were at least a quarter of the size they are now with so many less people. Even when I first got in the space, I made a list of crypto lawyers and there's maybe 45, 50, and now there's chats with 200 plus and there's multiple of them. It's amazing to see it grow. And I think a lot of that is because people recognize use cases. They see the potential here and they see what could be done, particularly lawyers, where we see how much of society is just based on trust. When you think of the use cases in crypto, are there any that come to mind that make you really bullish on the space?
So I think for me, again, like the root thing that has attracted me to blockchain is seeing it as a framework for incentivizing human collaboration and kind of collective action. And I think it started with a exploration of open source software. And then the question in my mind, like, to try to explain the mentality of developers that were contributing to these projects, right? Why would somebody that's super skilled and could charge a lot for their time contribute to something publicly? And then you realize that open source software is kind of the backbone of a lot of the infrastructure that we use today. So that was always a curiosity in my mind. And then what I see crypto as doing is basically supercharging that potential dynamic by giving contributors economic upside to the development of these kind of networks and doing so in a transparent and immutable way. So I think as like the root use case, that is it for me, incentivizing human coordination. So naturally, like, DAOs have been a big focus of my time. And I think, Frank, if you want to put an arc to it, I was very idealistic, and now I'm realizing there's a lot of friction with the existing legal system. So I think it's going to be a slug. I'm still kind of optimistic about it in the medium to long term, but I think short term, there's going to be a lot of resettlement of stuff.
I think many people go through that same arc where you're really enthusiastic and you see the potential. I know when I was in law school talking about crypto, this is going to change everything. And you start to realize how the existing system works and understanding where there's room for improvement, but also just where there is that friction. And it's so difficult to break through that inertia that is the existing system. And in terms of DAOs, we'll talk quite a bit on DAOs. Before we do that, I'd love to talk a bit about your role at Paradigm. Could we talk about what you do as crypto counsel and why you joined
Paradigm? Sure. So, I mean, maybe starting with why I joined, I was, I think, one of the odd outside counsel that really enjoyed my job. I was at Cooley, had been practicing kind of in the venture space, focused on crypto for a while. And I got into the place where I was working with a lot of entrepreneurs that I identified with on a personal basis. There were people that I would consider my friends, and I felt very helpful to them. And as someone that was, as I've been always like a frustrated creative person, being able to enable people to build cool stuff was awesome. So that was kind of me grinding along in my basement in Seattle. And then I got connected to some of the folks at Paradigm. And it was one of those, like, why the hell not would you talk to these people? If anything, it could be like a business development opportunity. So I started chatting with them. And I think it was really the opportunity to collaborate with some of the folks there. Fred and Matt, the co-founders, are both super impressive people, but you also have Dan Robinson, Samsung, a bunch of people that in my mind are like legends of crypto. So when I got the chance to join, it just sounded like a dream job and an opportunity to kind of really dive into the forefront of the fight. I felt like I was kind of dancing around the well, if you will, and that was like a chance to just jump in.
Yeah, when you're outside counsel, they're coming to you and you're helping with a specific task and a small thing here and there, but you're shining the sword for them to go back to battle.
Yeah, for sure. I think this has given me a chance to kind of dive deeper into some of the issues that I could have as outside counsel and really kind of, I think working with folks like Dan and Sam and doing a little bit more of the policy work as well has been really cool.
Yeah. So then could you talk about what you do day to day? Is it like largely policy focused? Is there a mix of policy, typical general counsel work? What does that look
like? Yeah. So I think about it in kind of three different buckets. I help Paradigm do some of its investments, especially when it involves a token or weird DAO structuring element. So it'll be like deal churning as a part of it. I also try to work directly with some of our portfolio founders to help them think through some of the legal issues, especially with a view to like things that I can then try to open source or thinking that can help other folks in the ecosystem more broadly. And most recently, I've been also doing a fair amount of helping Paradigm take its public position on different policy issues. So ranging from things like just compliance at the base layer to some of the work that we've been doing with DAO liability, like the Uki, Amicus, and others.
Yeah, I'd love to talk a bit about the Uki Amicus brief in terms of what you guys wrote and how you see this playing out. On December 20th, I believe that was the most recent update that we've had, saying that the CFTC's case can move forward, saying that the liability of the DAO or any member will be decided at the later stage of the case. But I think you tweeted that the silver lining is that the order shows Judge Oreck is thinking carefully about extending liability. Could you expand on that a bit and how you see it?
Sure. So maybe a helpful way to have an entry point into this discussion is kind of thinking about it procedurally. So what happened was the CFTC announced a settlement with the two founders of B0X and the development company. At the same time, they charged the quote-unquote Uki DAO. And under their theory of liability, they think that when the founders basically transitioned some of the admin powers to the smart contracts of the DAO, they quote-unquote transferred control or operation of the protocol to the DAO. And so in the CFTC's mind, they think if this was illegal when a company was doing it, it should be also illegal when the DAO is doing it, right? So they sued the DAO by serving them the process through the chat box and an online forum. And the judge, Judge Oreck, originally kind of, I assume, thinking there was just kind of a pro forma motion, approved the alternative service. And then four different Amici joined the fray. So we had Lexpunk, DeFi Ed Fund, Paradigm, and Andreessen each file amicus briefs, basically arguing that the service hadn't been proper and that the DAO basically could not be served, right? We had an interesting oral argument on that issue. And then, perhaps not unsurprisingly, Judge Oreck ruled that the service was unfortunately proper, so the case is moving on. And we're now at the point where the CFTC can request that the judge enter a default judgment against the DAO. So I think the key issue now to be resolved is how limited, like the scope of that default, right? So I think that the real fight now is to make sure that default is as narrowly scoped as possible, and that if it is ultimately going to be enforced against any of the members of the DAO, that they have basic ability to litigate all of the issues. So they're not precluded from litigating any of the issues that have been touched on so far in the litigation. Because I guess the underlying point here that maybe is too obvious that I should have mentioned at the top is that no one has responded for the DAO, right? So it's been a very one-sided procedure with only the amicus kind of trying to put forth arguments for why the DAO's liability should be limited, but no one responding directly.
Thank you for that background. And you had a great thread on the oral arguments. I think anyone who read that would have really benefited from it. What was the main justification for saying that this service was effectuated when serving through the chat box?
So, I mean, I think at a high level, I think the part of the thinking is, and this is based on some kind of unfortunate quotes from some of the founders, is that the project was quote unquote styled as a DAO in order to become enforcement proof. So a lot of the thinking of the CFTC and Judge Oreck was that like the DAO could not avoid liability by trying to structure itself in this way and not have any physical address or contact information. And the judge found that given that the CFTC had basically posted the service in the forums that were most kind of publicly used by the community, and there was also some discussion about the reaction that the community had to some of those posts, that they had met their burden and it had in fact notified the members.
It's tough when the facts of the case are not the perfect situation, particularly when you're trying to defend a DAO and write these briefs and everything too. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out, particularly when it comes to member liability, if they're found to be a general partnership, unincorporated association, and then how that liability is extended to these primarily, I assume, pseudonymous individuals who hold governance tokens and maybe they voted on them. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
So far, the CFTC in its consolidated answer to the amicus briefs and in the oral arguments has indicated that it's only trying to enforce this against the quote-unquote DAO. And I think what they mean by that is like the DAO treasury, and that they don't want to go after individuals. So I'm hoping that's where it ends up. But you ask, what is the result? I think one of the unfortunate results is that a lot of DAO token holders are looking at the CFTC's kind of line drawing around voting and saying, I'm just not going to vote in order to try to minimize my potential liability. And that to me is like a terrible result, because the whole point of, in my view, like crypto and DAOs is to like incentivize collaboration and new kind of governance structures. And if everyone's afraid to, because they're going to have a massive liability attached to it, it just doesn't work at all.
And do you think this case can be distinguished in the fact that largely due to what the CFTC is alleging was an illegal activity that was occurring before, and then it just continued to occur get with a message essentially saying that we're shifting to this, we won't have liability anymore, etc. Whereas if the DAO is running something that doesn't run afoul of existing registration requirements and things, or are the existing rules so broad that many DAO activities could fall under that? I'd love to hear your thoughts on how DAO members should think of their personal liability, given the different use cases of DAOs and how widely those...
So I think how DAO members should think about their liability is exactly starting where you left off. It's like, what are the activities of this DAO? Because as DAO is one of the words that has really come in vogue and used to refer to many very different things. So not very meaningful itself. But I think a lot of token holders should definitely think rigorously about their potential liability. I think one of the things that I've been seeing a lot is also when DAOs are not quote unquote wrapped, token holders themselves trying to set up some sort of legal entity that is the vehicle through which they hold the tokens or interact, so that there's potential, if there's not limited liability at the DAO level, there's potentially limited liability at the token holder level. But I think the CFTC's action against Ookie is unfortunate, like both a harbinger of more litigation to come and also something that is going to be used by other litigants, right? And at the of this is, I think, a very advantageous procedural posture for plaintiffs, because what we've seen so far in these cases against DAOs is that a plaintiff will sue a quote-unquote DAO, but that entity isn't really able to respond to the lawsuit. And if you think about it, like if the organization is truly decentralized, it should be very hard for somebody to respond directly. And also the members themselves individually are all heavily disincentivized from responding, because if they do, they could be found to be jointly and severally liable. So you have these situations where basically plaintiffs are litigating cases that are unopposed and like seeking to score points while the other team's off the court, and then go enforce that default judgment against whatever plaintiff they think is identifiable and likely to be the best to enforce against. So I think we're going to see a lot more of these types of litigations. And I think it's very important for token holders themselves and also DAO communities, right, to have a plan for how they're going to react to this. And I think it's very fact dependent and going to look very different in a community that has a DAO wrapper versus one that's like has dissolved it. So yeah, I think it's going to be one of the key issues to be solved, and it's going to affect basically whether DAOs are viable in the US.
Yeah, it's such a good point you made about how it's that catch 22 where there's not one group, there shouldn't at least be one group, as long if it's close to what a true DAO should be. There's not that one group that would respond on behalf of the DAO. But then if someone puts their hand up, now all of a sudden you're a potential target for the full swath of liability in this case as that DAO member.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think two nuances on that to explore. I think there are a lot of potential structures that help address this that are not direct responses. So, like, you know, you can have folks file amicus briefs. And I think that helps if nobody responds at all in the lawsuit, like as a defendant directly. I think the judge's hands are tied and ultimately they will enter a default, but it can help to shape that default and the proceedings. And there's also, I think, a lot of kind of industry groups or other types of ways that DAOs can coordinate outside of that immediate process to try to de-risk it. We're seeing also, for example, in the Maker community, they just voted to set up a legal defense fund. So basically an indemnity fund for members of Maker that are sued. And you're seeing other folks kind of explore different trust structures, service, indemnity, or insurance almost. So I think there are options, but yeah, it's a tricky situation for sure.
And there were a couple other cases that you mentioned too that were interesting and you were keeping an eye on regarding class action. Do you want to give some background to those who might not be familiar with them?
Sure. I think there's three main cases to keep an eye out, and they're all brought by the same plaintiff's law firm. The first one was the Pool Together case. So Pool Together is a no-loss lottery, and a plaintiff that I think invested something like, or deposited, I should say, $10 into Pool Together ended up suing them, claiming that they were running an unregistered lottery and that the development company, the founder, and a lot of the investors were acting as a kind of unincorporated partnership whose purpose was to allegedly operate this unregistered lottery offering. And then you had the same law firm file a complaint against the development company, the founders, and a couple of investors in B0X. So kind of the private lawsuit for the same project that the CFTC is suing. And then most recently, they brought a case against Dow, which alleges that like there was a unregistered securities offering, including their liquidity mining program.
Okay. And thanks for the background on those. Is there anything within those cases that you're particularly keeping an eye on with regards to DAOs, member liability, anything that we've discussed so far? Or are these more lawsuits that were brought just because anyone can bring a lawsuit and it might not have larger ramifications? Or is it too soon to say and it's just a good thing to keep an eye on these cases?
So I think these three cases the legal theory of liability in each of the three cases depends on, at some level, on there being kind of an incorporated association or general partnership that binds all the parties, right? So I think it is going to be very interesting to see them play out and could potentially have precedential effect for other lawsuits, right? And kind of, I think the key issues to keep in mind are, one, the service process issues, which we've already discussed, then kind of this line drawing exercise of if it's a partnership, like who's, like what do you have to do as a token holder to become a potential general partner? Is it just holding a token? So I think that's the theory that you see in some of the private lawsuits, for example, pooled together. There's no component there of having to vote your tokens to be able to be a general partner. And then I think the related question is, what rights are individual members going to have if there's the case where the quote unquote DAO defaults?
Yeah. Yeah. It will be interesting to see how these play out, because I think the impact they'll have, like you've already alluded to, the chilling effect that a lot of people spoke about when it comes to the Ookie DAO decision relating to, not decision, but the allegations relating to voting in governance forums and the like, because you're disincentivizing what makes these essentially operate. Without the governance voting, it's very difficult to see the long-term potential here. And it could be really dangerous to be putting out the fire at such an early stage just because of one particular case. And so it's a shame with all this enforcement money that's pouring in, they can't use that to create some sensible regulations. What are your thoughts on that? Do you see some regulation coming down the pipeline in a way that's tenable for DAOs in their existing or ideal form?
So maybe to start with one of the earlier premises of your question, I'm very sympathetic to the idea that decentralization, or like calling something a DAO, cannot just be a magic wand that makes liability disappear for everybody. So I'm sympathetic to the regulators in that regard. What I think the main disconnect lies is that I don't think people are using DAOs to quote unquote evade regulation or become enforcement proof. I think these are genuinely a new kind of primitive for social coordination that doesn't fit into any existing framework. So I think what we ultimately will need is a state to develop a new form of legal entity. That sounds kind of crazy and far-fetched until you realize that the LLC hasn't been around for more than a few generations, right? So I think Miles and David Kerr have been doing some really good work trying to push the UNA as a potential framework for this. You also see Wyoming, other states kind of experimenting with variations of the LLC law. In my mind, the ideal would be kind of a new entity from scratch that doesn't necessarily borrow from these other existing frameworks and tries to adapt it to crypto, but really something that's designed whole cloth for a DAO. But I think that would be the ultimate solution to it.
And I think it's doable. If you look at the existing laws and you can carve out certain pieces with whether it's there's no need to KYC holders of the token to you're able to form this entity that can either pay taxes itself or have, you know, the partners pay taxes. If you, and co-ops are a good example as well, like there's so many different existing rules that can be compiled to create something for this space to move forward in its own entity. Because I agree with you. I think trying to, legal wrappers work and they work for certain things, but trying to put a DAO in a legal wrapper doesn't fit in a way that it perhaps should and could and really needs to go forward.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think the one analogy that I've used is a lot of wrappers are kind of like a blanket where like your toes are sticking out, and people don't realize that, right? Like they think that a legal entity kind of covers all of the activities and members of a DAO just if you have anyone. But a lot of these don't, right? So I think there's going to be a lot of surprises when projects that have legal entities are still litigating cases against them that charge them as unincorporated partnerships, because they are going to be surprised that the entity that they formed is not coextensive with all their activities and potential liability.
Yeah, and even just thinking of that analogy brings to mind to me the offshore entities where an offshore foundation is created. We've seen all sorts of structuring done offshore with the primary market being onshore in different jurisdictions, primarily the US. And you tweeted, offshore structures can help shield DAO members from liability and decentralize the governance and operations of protocols, but need to be carefully set up. And the second part of that sentence is so important. Could we talk a bit about your thoughts on the offshore setup when it comes to DAOs? And you could have this one entity that issues the tokens, another entity that shepherds the protocol, holds the IP, things like that.
Sure. So I think the first thing to point out is that I think a lot of the offshoring is a response to perceived unfavorable domestic regime or like unclear regime, right? So projects are scared of what they would do if they are quote unquote in the US, and they have this somewhat knee-jerk reaction of like, oh, let me just form some entities outside of the US and a tool to kind of slim my potential exposure in the US. I think some of these can help, but they are not going to work if there's a big US nexus, right? I think the first hurdle here is tax-driven. So if you have a bunch of developers who are in the US, a bunch of US investors, a bunch of token holders there in the US, you can't just form an offshore entity and then pretend like you're not going to have any tax issues, right? So there's ECI, CFC, PFIC issues that someone that is smarter than me can explain on this podcast at some point. But at a high level, like if a lot of the value is being driven or a lot of the activity is in the US, the IRS is going to look very closely at the project. And I think that shoe is still to drop. But I think that's one of the biggest liabilities. And then from a kind of regulatory like SEC perspective, I think that if the offshore entities share kind of a common governance structure with the onshore entities, they're not going to be very effective shields for liability for things like unregistered token offerings. So for example, in the SEC's recent complaint against Avi, the Mango hacker, they mentioned kind of in passing that Mango had used the Panamanian Foundation to issue the token, but don't give any thought as to whether that would isolate the US or would mean that the token was not issued as an unregistered securities, right? The posture there is a little weird because they're not charging Mango directly. It's a complaint against Avi, but you could see their thinking that they're not going to be paid by the fact that there was an offshore entity. So I think for there, like as with the tax analysis, the key is like, who's making the decisions? Are they really independent from the US?
It goes back to the typical legal form of looking at it in that it's substance over form, right? If you call something decentralized and it's a DINO, like it's a DAO in name only, it doesn't matter. If you, whatever you call it, you could call it whatever you like. You're going to be considered liable for something if you are liable for breaking any particular laws. Just like if you're offshore, but all the activities are onshore, there's a sufficient nexus, there will be an issue there. Do you see offshore as being the long-term answer, or do you think we'll start to see regulation that's compatible with this existing system, just given how it is such a software-focused industry and that you can easily set up anywhere in the world?
I mean, I don't know. My predictive power is very low. I hope that we figure it out in the US, because I think the jurisdiction that is able to develop the right framework for crypto that attracts developers while also addressing some of the big risks is going to have a lot to gain. I think you can look at the internet as an example and all the kind of wealth and prosperity that brought to the US. So I hope that we get it right. And I think the states are also starting to realize that they could have a lot to gain by developing a new legal entity framework that is friendly to DAOs. If you look at it as an example of a jurisdiction that's really been able to drive a lot of value for its state by developing, by being seen as the best place to incorporate and the best courts to litigate corporate issues, I think the same could be true for the kind of next generation.
That's a great example. I'm glad you mentioned Delaware because it's an example of how it's not the state itself that adds the value. It's the rules that the state has, which attract people, which then creates value in Delaware with the court system. Everything that they have regarding the modern day company corporation LLC is so structured to benefit, to increase efficiency when it comes to business. That's the primary reason business is driven there. It's not because of the scenic drives and beautiful forests that they have there, right? It's just the appeal from a business perspective and efficiency. And I think that whole analogy to the internet too, it's how you look at it. Like long-term, are we going to set up rules that will allow this to thrive? And if so, then the country will benefit largely from that. You had a great DAO legal entity matrix comparing the legal entities available for DAOs across a range of criteria, formation requirements, liability of members, tax, etc. It's on a public Notion page. I really recommend people check it out. I'll link it in the show notes below. Having done this and having gone through, you've written tons of great articles on DAOs. What should DAO members consider when determining the best legal framework from their DAO? Should it be go through the matrix, look at the criteria, think about how it applies to you, and then select what makes the most sense? Or what would you sort of say to DAOs and members of DAOs that are thinking about this?
Yeah, I think as a first level point, I don't think there's any perfect solution here. So I think it's really kind of risk minimizing and trying to understand the risk that you're taking so that there's no unknown risks that you're taking, right? But again, since people use the word DAO to refer to a lot of different things, I think the first step is kind of understanding what type of activities you're going to be taking, right? Because something like launching a new AM looks very different than a social DAO that votes on where to host parties. So I think once you have that in scope, then think about the tax liabilities. I think figuring out tax is, I think, most important. Think about how much U.S. nexus you have, because I think some of the offshore structures, like we said, are potentially more appealing if you can truly be a project that's outside of the U.S. And then think about how much you want to spend on your legal structuring, because I think there are lightweight solutions and there's a lot more kind of bespoke things that you can do. And I think just keeping in mind general corporate law principles about agency and I think minority protection and some of the things that have come up in the history are also a good way to try to de-risk what you're doing by drawing on those lessons.
Yeah, that's a great point, because you can encode the lessons that have been learned through history, create an incentive mechanism to avoid these coming up again in the future. And that's why DAOs are so exciting to me, because we can take these lessons, we can take these rules and things that can be so expensive to enforce through courts and legal contracts and put them all on chain. Let's shift gears, and this will be the last substantive question, to NFTs and CC0. I enjoyed your thread that explored some of the benefits and drawbacks. And we've seen licenses change over time. But could we discuss how CC0 works and its advantages?
Sure. So as my part of my job at Paradigm, I've been working with a couple of NFT projects and doing a lot of thinking about what the right licensing framework was for NFT projects, right? And there's definitely been a wave in projects that have released their art under CC0. At a basic level, what CC0 is, it's a Creative Commons license that is the kind of most extreme, or like no rights reserved license. So the idea is that you try to waive your rights to and copyright to the art to the greatest extent possible globally. There are some questions as to how efficiently that or how efficacious it is in certain jurisdictions, but it's, in my mind, the farthest you can go in open sourcing your works of art, right? And it's been interesting to watch the various CCO projects develop, because I do think that it, at its root, it could provide a new framework for incentivizing content creation. If you think about copyright as a tool, what copyright is supposed to do is incentivize artists to create art by giving them the right to exclude others from that art so that they can monetize that access, right? Zero is almost the diametric opposite of that. They're saying, I'm not going to limit any access. You can do whatever you want with this art, right? But I think when layered onto like NFTs, you can create these, again, framework for value capture in the token itself that could lead to artists wanting to create works or being incentivized to create works, even though they're like given away for free. And I think some of the benefits that releasing something under CC0 has are, number one, kind of like community engagement. It's like much more likely to be like memed or viral because anybody can use it. Anybody can riff on it, right? But by the same token, it's, in my view, much more likely to get integrated into other projects. So like the composability of it, I think, is higher. And if you think about a lot of NFT PFP projects as future avatars that are going to be integrated in some metaverse, it makes sense to have your art have or be able to be integrated into other projects as easily as possible to kind of lower the friction. And I think one early example of this is in the Super Bowl commercial last year. You saw like the Nouns glasses and a Budweiser commercial, right? And then there's this question about like whether it can change the way that value accrues to works of art. So I think that the traditional conception is that like the copies can be diluted to the original, right? Especially if it's like shitty copies of your art. But I think if you look at kind of meme culture and NFTs, there's definitely value that can accrue to the original of something. So during the kind of the NFT boom, we saw people tokenizing and selling like a lot of the early internet images that we all like love and are like seared into our brains, right? So if you think about it with that mindset, you start to realize that maybe like allowing somebody to make unlimited copies of your art can actually return value to the original. Yeah, I think there's a couple of other like risks and downsides to releasing something under CC0, right? For projects that are thinking about monetizing their work kind of through traditional sponsorship licensing deals with more traditional media companies, I think it could create issues to release something under CC0. So I think in a way you are foregoing some potential avenues of monetization. I think a big one too is as a creator, you're ceding a lot of control of the development of the narrative. It's almost like a grassroots storytelling when you release into something under zero, right? Because anybody can take it, riff on it, create a derivative. So if you're a creator that wants to be very hands-on and tightly control how your content is used and developed, CC0 might not be the best. And it also can conflict with existing IP rights, right? So you can't, you can only release something under CC0 if you have kind of like complete rights to it. So it wouldn't work for content that's already, or it would have to be closely looked at if you've already licensed the content or somebody else has pre-existing IP rights.
Yeah, no, I don't think enough people make that point. And I think you are the first one to articulate it that well, in that it changes how value accrues when you have the NFTs in the mix. And before NFTs, CC0, it might not have made as much sense because you don't have that foundational piece that can grow in value as the virality of this object grows. Now you do. And I think it's more of a long-term play where maybe there are movies, shows, a community built around this, and the owner of that NFT can see tons of value accrue to them, or the creator who has a royalty built in that is honored throughout. Rather, you have a paper contract and that's honored, and then you have sort of a native group that you've paid and is part of this core team to build out. So it's much more grassroots approach. And I think you articulated that really well. So thank you for that answer. Last question for you, Rodrigo. And this is a two-parter, so you can choose to answer both. You can choose to answer one of them. What habits have helped you cultivate a successful career? Are there things you try to bring into your daily life, weekly, monthly, that have been helpful for you? And or what advice were you given early on in your career that shaped who you have become today?
So maybe taking the second one first. One piece of advice that my corporations professor, John Coates, gave me in law school that I think really affected the way that I have navigated my career so far was, he mentioned that when there's a big regulatory shift in the sense of fundamental change in legislation or a new regulatory framework, there's a lot of potential for young lawyers to jump in and really kind of accelerate their careers by becoming subject matter experts. And I've seen this, I think, firsthand. I started at a New York law firm working for M&A partners that had been partners at that law firm for longer than had been alive in the world. and the knowledge barrier and just like the totem pole was like so massive that it was hard to like even think of them as like being lawyers in the same realm that you were, right? You could like barely look at them in the eye. And I think in crypto, I guess first, we're yet to see the big regulatory change. I think that's coming. But there's enough uncertainty that I think, and enough new things happening on the tech side, that I think there's a ton of opportunity for young people to dive in, try to understand the tech, try to be first eyes on a lot of deep developments, and very quickly become quote unquote experts in the field, right? Even though you might not have been practicing for 30 years. And in terms of kind of habits, and I think this might sound cliche, but like just do what you think is interesting. I think my drive towards crypto has been in one part kind of like this opportunity that I saw professionally, but also just, man, I just think it's the coolest things you could be doing as a crypto lawyer. And I think the other advice is just try to show up with your personality. I think a lot of people, especially young lawyers in big law firms, particularly if you don't come from a family that has had lawyers throughout, like you feel the need to put on this kind of facade and repeat back the language that you hear and like kind of take on all these mannerisms. And I think people really appreciate genuine interaction. So if you can find a way to bring more of yourself into your practice, I think that is a good thing.
That's great. I appreciate those. And I think they're such important reminders, especially in law firms where it's so easy to focus on fitting in and not rocking the boat and just being another associate, especially in the early years that puts their head down. They're a grinder, gets the work done. But you kind of don't want to stand out because typically that's not a good thing super early on in a career, unless you're in crypto, which by that you're sort of forced to.
Yeah. I mean, I think it goes even deeper than that, right? Like if you think about the US common law system and you think about kind of all the opinions that have been handed down and like the language that has been used, I think it's the language of like a very select group of part of the population, right? And I think a lot of people feel the need to adopt that and reflect that. One of my favorite writers is Unot Diaz, who's a like Latina writer, has won the Pulitzer Prize. And the thing that like I really admire about him is that he's like unabashedly like Latino in his language, and he's been able to get recognized by the Academy. So I think someone that's able to kind of break through but still maintain a sense of genuineness is, you know, what we should all strive for.
Yeah, the world needs more individuals, right? It's so easy to become a society where it's just more of the same between everybody. And the more people that embrace what's unique about them, the more unique the world experience is for everyone else. And those are the people really who stand out. I think the fact that he won a Pulitzer isn't surprising, given that he was willing to have the courage to embrace what was unique about him and bring that out into the world and share that with everybody. So that was great. The one thing I have to ask, is there a story behind your PFP?
My goal in life is to become a gentleman rancher.
Amazing.
Yes.
And you got some property, which we spoke about earlier. So it sounds like you're doing pretty well on the way to that goal.
Yes, sir. Hopefully.
Amazing.
Next cycle.
Amazing, Rodrigo. Well, thanks so much for taking the time in. Enjoyed the conversation.
Yeah, take care.